When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a special emergency pre-recorded edition of Take the Black Live, the only show on the internet where we talk about all things sci-fi, fantasy, movies, TV, books, etc. We can't do our live show today, but we wanted to have something up for you guys, so we thought we would pre-record a little video, myself, Dan Salke of WindersComing.net, and Daniel Rowan of WindersComing.net.
Hello.
And for our subject, we have chosen to discuss a book. A book called The Shadow Rising, the fourth book in the Wheel of Time series. I'd hoped you brought a prop because I do not have one.
Always.
By Robert Jordan. Why discuss The Shadow Rising? Well, reason A. It is part of the Wheel of Time series, a very big fantasy series that is worth talking about. Reason number B. It's considered one of the better books in the series. And reason number C. It is going to be adapted in about 2 months' time, less than 2 months' time, as the third season of Amazon Prime Video's The Wheel of Time TV show. We're going to see the words of this book come to life on the small screen. So what better time to discuss what the book is, its high points, its low points, its place in the greater conversation that continues to this day between author Robert and his fans, among his fans. We're going to get to the bottom of The Shadow Rising, what it means, and how you can be prepared. Daniel, yes. I will ask a question to get things rolling. And it's kind of a rhetorical question, but also not. Is The Shadow Rising the best book in Robert Jordan's 14-book strong Wheel of Time series?
You know, this is not as rhetorical as you would think. I think this is a hard question. I saw that you were planning on asking this, and I've been racking my brain. Oh, so nice. We forgot reason D for this, which is a good little background for viewers, listeners. So, Dan, you just finished The Shadow Rising fairly recently, like a couple weeks ago. I've read the entire series, but it has been a while since I read The Shadow Rising. I think, you know, the hard thing about the Wheel of Time is that it has such incredible peaks and valleys. Like, my personal favorite book is probably the fifth one, The Fires of Heaven. Nice. But that is an unpopular opinion because there's a lot of slow stuff in there, too. You know, Knife of Dreams, if I'm looking over the camera, it's because I'm looking at the books on my shelf.
Sure.
That's another really good one. That's the last one Robert Jordan ever wrote, the 11th one. Lord of Chaos is the sixth, and similar to Fires of Heaven, it has some slow moments at the beginning, but probably one of the most iconic endings of the entire series. So it's hard to say Shadow Rising is like the all around best, but I think in terms of maybe consistency, Shadow Rising is where the series really gets its footing. You know, the first three books recycle a lot of beats. The end is always Rand fighting the same flaming-headed dude named Baal-Zamon, who we know as a Shamael from the show and also from the later books. But The Shadow Rising, it's where Robert Jordan kind of established his form with the books that he would use for the rest of the series. And I think when I think of, you know, books that have high points and low points, The Shadow Rising doesn't really have too many low points. Like, a lot happens in that book.
Yes.
Even if there are things we may or may not like as much. When I say low points, I mean like moments where Jordan spends like 70 pages off in the weeds describing like clothing, and like, not to shade that, people like that, but like there are times where he spends a lot of time doing very little on the page, compared to The Shadow Rising, where like a ton happens in this book. So yeah, I think we could say it is if not the best book in the series, because that's so hard. That's so hard to decide that. It is certainly one of the best books in the series. How's that non-answer?
I think it's really thorough and accurate, and I appreciate the detail. I have, like you said, I'm reading the series now. So this is the most recent book I've read, and I've only read the first four. So I'm going to keep going. But for me, it'd be between, of the ones I've read, the four I've read, it's either this one or The Eye of the World. I did like the first one. I thought it had a propulsion to it, and everything was just new and novel and fresh, and it felt exciting. I agree with you that the second and third books, there was new stuff in there, but they tended to recycle a bit. The Shadow Rising felt like a step forward. It did. Yeah. It felt like they were not repeating things anymore. It didn't end with the same, like you said, Rand fighting the same guy four times in a row. We were done with that. And it was definitely content rich. If there's one thing I can say for The Shadow Rising that maybe I couldn't for the other three books, maybe the first one, is that I can tell you a lot of what happened, because a lot happened.
Yes.
There's a lot to go over. Were there any of the big plots that are favorites of yours or appeal to for any reason?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one for me is probably Rand going to Ruidian. That is always, when I think of the Shadow Rising, that is one of the first things that comes to mind. Because one, we learn the origins of the Aiel. We also get to see the Aiel in the present day a lot in the Shadow Rising. So it's cool because we kind of like learn about their culture and what it's like after just hearing a little bit about them in the previous books. And then on the flip side of that, we're seeing where they came from, how they branched. So for people watching, this will have Shadow Rising spoilers. It will not have later book spoilers. But we do see kind of how the Aiel are related to the Tuatha, the traveling folk, and the Way of the Leaf and stuff like that. And all of that's so interesting. I think Jordan does like vision sequences. That's something he really liked writing. And I think The Shadow Rising has arguably his best one, or one of his best ones, with the whole Ruidian trip. So there are others that are absolutely highlights, but when I think of the book, that's the first thing that comes to mind. What about you? What were some things you loved on this, your first read of this book?
It's cool that you say he does a vision swell, because when I think of the book, what I think of first is that vision thing in Ruidian. By the way, side note, if the show premieres and they pronounce it Ruidian and not Ruidian, are you going to lose it?
No, just like I don't say Moiraine, I still say Moiraine. Although, listen to the audiobook, right? So that's why you're saying it that way. I won't dispute. I think it's Michael Kramer and Kate Redding do the audiobooks for these. They're very famous audiobook narrators. I'm sure they pronounce things the right way, but I've got my own headcanon. I am curious to see how they pronounce it in the show, though.
Me too. Are you going to start saying Ruidian and words
if they pronounce it that way?
I don't know. There are a lot of, that was a loud ass sip. There are a lot of words, names, places in these books that are not, just don't roll the tongue naturally. And we'll probably see some discussion and maybe some fighting. It'll be fun. But yes. The vision, the thing said about the vision sequences is cool, because I think of that vision that Rand has in Ruidian, whatever, where he does learn about the Aiel's past, where they kind of branched off from this much more peaceful people who he'd already met to become a warrior people, essentially. It was, I don't know if he planned it, but it felt very neat and organized and cool and interesting and surprising and sensical. Which is hard. It's like a hard target to hit when you're doing a lore reveal, to like make it be a legitimate twist that doesn't really contradict anything that came before and make it hit emotionally. And I thought it was very cool. I also loved, not quite a vision, I also loved Matt Cawthon's encounter with the wicked snake people of the Upside Down or whatever they were. Just because I didn't really know, and the book doesn't really explain exactly what their deal is. I like that it kept that sort of ambiguous and strange and weird and eerie. It sticks out in my head. I liked both of those moments a lot. I mean, I think my favorites were the Aiel stuff. I also liked the Tanchico sections mostly, which were a little slower. So Nynaeve and Elaine and Tom Marilyn and a fourth guy whose name I forget go to the city of Tanchico to
Julian, right?
Yeah, I think they pronounce it. Of course they do in the audiobook, but we can debate this back and forth forever. To hunt down the Black Aja. That was cool. When I think of it, I think of Nynaeve fighting another one. Mogadine is how they say it in the audiobooks, not Mogadian or whatever, which is just memorable. Like one of our characters yes. fights a Forsaken and lives to tell the tale. And Nynaeve is always so fun because she's always so kind of headstrong and bullheaded. And I just love what it might do for her ego to fight and beat a Forsaken sorceress. That's fun.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Man, I'm so excited for you to keep reading these because, yeah, Nynaeve has a journey is all I'll say in regards to how she, you know, processes her encounter with Mogadian, which, you know, commenters, feel free to chime in the comments and let us know how you pronounce these names. But yeah, that's another one that obviously stands out to me, Nynaeve versus Mogadian. And I think that that is really notable for a few reasons. One, just it's a memorable scene. She fights her in this museum that has all these ancient relics. And the other side of that is that we've gotten the Forsaken built up so much throughout the series up until this point where they're like, they're these figures of myth and legend. They're terrifying. They will... Mm-hmm. boil you in your boots as quick as look at you if they catch you in a bad spot. Like, they're so dangerous. And here we see, like, actually the kind of new heroes rising in this current age are some of them are like a comparable strength to the Forsaken. They just don't have those centuries of ancient knowledge or whatever. So, and Nynaeve versus Mogadian is really like the first really clear example of that, I think, where it's not like, you know, in the third book, Moiraine knew a forbidden spell, the Balefire that she used, and and everyone was like, oh, she just erased a dude from time. We didn't even know you could do that. Or Rand fighting Forsaken, where obviously he's the Dragon Reborn. Here it's just another channeler who is extremely powerful and strong enough to stand toe-to-toe with Mogadine, lady.
Yeah, I like what you said about, so it recontextualizes them because a lot of this book is recontextualizing the story, which you already kind of touched on. Again, the first three were kind of all had sort of the same structure with things in there. I love the Shan Chan stuff and the Great Hunt. That was new and exciting.
Yeah, that was a favorite of mine too.
But here, like, okay, so the Forsaken are kind of brought down to earth and our main characters are going to lift it up to the level of heroes who will become legendary in time. We return to the Two Rivers, which is kind of like a Odysseus coming back home sort of thing. How have things changed? That is a recontextualization. The White Tower coup, that place falls, that changes. It did feel like things moved forward a lot in this book, which I liked. All four. And honestly, I was going to say the Tanchico plot doesn't really move forward things much, but I think that Forsaken fight is pretty important to kind of understanding who they are. The Aiel obviously recontextualizes the Aiel and the history of the world. We got a lot of new meat on the bones in this book. I will say, speaking of the Forsaken, one of the ones that didn't really connect with me, so I read, or rather listened to this book twice, and both times, the climax is Rand and the Forsaken channeler Asmodian. Is that how they say it?
In your head?
Great.
Yes.
racing to get to the magical doohickey. I forget what exactly it is. It's a Sangreal.
Isn't it the key to the Chodan call?
That's going to help him do something good. What's that?
Isn't it the key to the Chodan call? Isn't that?
Yeah, maybe, sure. Fine. Yeah, you look it up.
They're
racing to get to the magical weapon. They're racing to get to the MacGuffin. Come on, we can just say that. And both times, I almost forgot who this character he's fighting is or racing against is. And I heard it twice. I thought the climax was kind of weak, like for that to be the big ending note for Ran to be in a race against this character who I sort of kind of remember when you bring him up, but not really. But there was so much good work going on all over the place. And the characters were all separated. There was no like kind of coming together. There was no everyone joins back and does some final thing that it was fine. But I wasn't terribly moved by the Asmodean reveal because I had trouble remembering who he was whenever he wasn't on the page.
Yeah. So this is interesting to me. And I do think there are points in the Wheel of Time that are better in retrospect the farther you get into the series. Mm-hmm. And I do think the capturing of Asmodean is definitely one of them. So the thing that stands out to me more about the Asmodean stuff isn't just that he was there. Like that was one of the reveals. Asmodean has been there all along, traveling the Aiel Waste with Rand, pretending to be a bard. I'm very, very curious to see how the show does this. And yeah, I believe Rand finds out he's going to Ruidian to get, I'm pretty sure it's the key to the Chodan Call, which is an Angriel or Cyangriel that lets them access an even more powerful Angriel with basically like a world shattering amount of the one power in it.
A doohickey that lets them unlock the gate to the key to the magic device. Yeah,
more or less. Yes. So that whole the race through the dimension, where they like it's almost like fast traveling. That has never been something I particularly liked in the Wheel of Time. That always confused me a little bit. I'm sure it'd be a little clearer if I reread the series, but even still, there are just some parts where in my head I'm like, I don't like this quite as much. And that has always been one of them, like the race to get there through that other dimension. But I do really like the way that ended with Lanfear helping Rand capture Asmodean, because a running theme of the book so far has been Rand has no one to teach him how to use the one power. And he really needs that because otherwise he might just destroy a bunch of stuff. So if I remember right, the kind of end note is now we've captured this guy. Maybe he can teach you some things, even though he doesn't want to be with you because he's a Forsaken. That I really liked. And I will say that plot line going forward is something that I enjoyed.
Yeah, I didn't. It was fine. Just, it was the fact that it was like sold as the climax felt a little off because I didn't think it was the most climactic thing that happened in the book. But you got to end it somewhere. Fair. And it totally worked. I'm wondering, too, how they'll do that and do a lot of things because there are some things. Is there anything you're particularly interested in seeing how they adapt to the screen or afraid of how they'll adapt to the screen or really looking forward to it?
There are a few that I'm looking forward to and one that I'm especially nervous about. Okay, so I am I'm looking forward to seeing Bruidian, obviously. Mm-hmm. 90 versus Mogedion. When I think of this series, that is always a scene that stands out in my mind. So obviously I'm very excited to see that in the show. The one I'm most nervous about is Matt's, because you mentioned Matt going through the doorways, meeting the creepy snake people and fox people, the Eelfin and Aelfin. That's something that I always really liked in the book. It's important for Matt because after that second meeting, he gets hanged. He gets his iconic weapon that he has for basically the rest of the series, the Ashandaray, which is like a bladed spear. He gets a fox head medallion that protects him from the one power, which is a very important thing for him to have for the whole rest of the series, pretty much. And I think he gets his hat. So like there's a bunch of stuff like that where I really liked all of the Matt stuff, and we know for a fact at this point that Matt is going to Tanchico instead of the Aiel Waste with Rand. We don't know that he will never end up in the Aiel Waste, but in the most recent images that dropped the week that we're recording this, they did confirm that Matt is in Tanchico in season 3, which is a deviation from the book where he did not go to Tanshiko. So I am like cautiously hopeful because they already foreshadowed that Matt is going to have the whole hanging thing where, and then his memories start filling in more. They already foreshadowed that in season 2. He drinks the bad tea from Ms. Shamael. He gets visions. And one of the visions is he sees himself hanging. So I don't think they're going to totally cut all of that, but I am a little anxious to see how they maneuver through it because it is a really memorable part of the book series. So that's the one I'm most nervous about. And then we haven't even touched the Two Rivers yet, but let's do that after you say whatever you're going to say.
I have nothing to add, really. Yeah, it's obviously the one big change we already know they're going to make. And
yeah,
without knowing how they do it, it's hard to really comment. It does bring up the question, just the biggest one is just why? You assume they must have a decent reason if they're doing something that big, but we can't really know until we see more.
Yeah, I think one, and I don't know for sure that this is all of it or whatever. You had mentioned, I think last time we talked about this, so the first doorway that Matt sees is in the Stone of Tyr, which that's another notable thing about this book is that for really like the first time, the book starts with like all the characters together again. And we get a solid chunk of time in the Stone of Tyr where they're all hanging out. We assume the show is not going to do that, or it's going to do that differently because we haven't even seen the Stone of Tyr in the show. They kind of glossed over a lot of the material from the Dragon Reborn, partially because a lot of it is a retread of things we've seen before and they needed to get through. So that doorway, presumably, if we're not going to the Stone of Tyr, has to be somewhere else. Tanshiko is my obvious guess. I still think he might see a doorway and Tanshiko go through it and then get spat out in the IO waste, but that's just speculating.
If you're writing in a universe where you can do things like travel to alternate dimensions, travel huge distances, you know, summon giant tidal waves, a lot does become possible.
Yeah.
So we'll see what they come up with. What did you think of the Perrin's trip back to his homeland in the Two Rivers and growing into a reluctant yellow-eyed leader of farm boys?
I remember mostly really liking Perrin's return to the Two Rivers. I liked something that the Wheel of Time did that really surprised me, was how much it turned away from the trope of like killing off all the heroes' parents and they never go home again until the very end of the series and everything's changed. I remember being really surprised in the Eye of the World when Tam'al Thor just doesn't die. Cause they set it up where it's like, he might die. And it's like, well, this is, you know, I'd read all these other fantasy books and the farm hero's parent getting killed is kind of like the starting point for a lot of them. So I was surprised that wasn't the case. I was surprised Robert Jordan brought Perrin back to the Two Rivers this early in the series. And we get to see the people of the Two Rivers kind of come into their own defending their town against Trollocs and corrupt White Cloaks who decide they're not going to help defend against the Trollocs because they want the Dark Friends there, namely Perrin. So I like that it was a little meaty and complicated. I liked getting to see the Two Rivers characters again. I liked Perrin growing into a leadership role. I'm going to say this lightly to avoid long game spoilers, but I think that's another one of those looking back on the series, I appreciate that moment more because it is important for Perrin and it's important for Perrin's story moving forward from here. And I really liked the way that Robert Jordan handled it here. Not to say that there weren't issues. I do remember, and I think this is something that might have bugged you too, or at least kind of relevant to it. Fail, and I think it's Barilane, like fighting over Perrin, was a thing that really bothered me. Because that we get that with a few of these characters, like women fighting over the man. And I'm like, I don't particularly love that as just a plot point. What did you think of the Two Rivers? And specifically the stuff with Perrin and the romances as well.
Well, for I'll say, we have another name in the audiobooks. It's Fael.
That one's, I bet that one's right. I'm sure I'm saying Fael wrong. Sorry, okay. Fael.
Like her Fael name's fans. Fael. Wow.
Fael. Shady. Yeah, Fael on my part. That one, I am like almost positive. I will not dispute that one.
Okay.
Fael Bashir.
Bashir. They say in the audiobooks. Can you imagine, like, I'm Perrin and this is my wife, Fael. Like,
that's right. Great. That's right.
I again, I like that it felt like there was a step forward, that Perrin did really grow as a character, because it's really sort of the first time in the books where we have some big forward momentum in those kind of areas.
Yeah, totally.
The characters in general, I'm enjoying the Wheel of Time books. They don't, and I think this is something that the show has tweaked a bit, mostly to my liking. A lot of them just do things I find hard to relate to, or that just don't really ring true to me. The Fael Perrin relationship, like the whole bit in the beginning where he says, "You can't come through the ways with me." She's like, "Well, I'm going to go through the ways with you." And then she like kind of stays behind him, like far enough to not trip up the little agreement they made. I think it's supposed to be funny, but it just kind of comes across as schoolyard games kind of level of relationships. And I know that they're young people. They're supposed to be like teenagers and they're navigating this stuff, but it just, a lot of it feels pretty immature, which I'm not sure is the effect he's going for. And I can't tell if it's just a function of the time when it was written and it would have read better back then, or if it always seemed weird and kind of cringy, but it felt weird and kind of cringy to me. The gender stuff, I'm not the first, second, or 800th person to point out that there is a weird gender dynamic in the Wheel of Time books, where Robert Jordan seems to treat men and women as like members of different species who cannot ever understand each other completely and do things separately and have their private cabals where they kind of generalize about the other sex. And it's just, it, like you said, it's very men are from Mars, women are from Venus. And it just comes across as silly to me. Like when I read that kind of stuff, it just doesn't ring true. It's a gender essentialist kind of story. There's this bit towards the end of the Two Rivers bit where Perrin does a thing, which is, again, it's not uncommon to do in these kind of stories, or a lot of stories from earlier, from like decades ago, where he's like, "I'm sending Fael away to save her. She can't be in this battle," even though she wants to be in the battle, which is fine, because I think that's okay for a character to do. But the way the book frames it, he like talks to other people, other women, and they're all like, "Perrin, you're doing the right thing." And like, is anybody going to object? Like, she wants to stay. Maybe there could be like one lone voice. And she ends up kind of going and getting an army to help him out. And I was like, why is the subterfuge needed at all? I think it's supposed to be romantic. It kind of comes across as gender essentialist and kind of just a way of looking at men and women that doesn't really jive with me. But the sections in general, I liked the conflicts. I like that he's fighting against White Cloaks and Trollocs. I remember that there was one, and I'm not going to go into it because I don't remember it well enough to comment on it. Some character who I think was like a really arrogant adventurer, horn seeker guy who ends up doing something or other, whatever. It was fun. Mostly I liked it. But, and that Fael gender thing isn't limited to that plot line either. It kind of seeps in everywhere. And that's one thing I think the show has updated by just kind of removing it.
Yeah, I do think that the show, that's something that they very clearly wanted to tackle head on, I think. And I also, you know, there were times that bothered me more than others throughout the Wheel of Time. I do think that it is one of the main aspects of the series that has not aged well. Not that it wasn't also perhaps problematic when it was published, because this was 1992 that The Shadow Rising came out. That's only a few years before A Game of Thrones. You know, we had plenty of series in fantasy and sci-fi that were out before that point that didn't have these issues, so it is something specific to the
real
time. I don't
want to write it off as like you had to be there. There are other things that don't have this.
I agree with that 100%. But I do think that the maturity, I think what you said about the maturity is fair. That's something that always bugged me as well, but it does feel like not to say relationships are shallower than like some of the more sweepingly adult fantasy that is out there. But, you know, like how many times do we get the joke of like Matt and Perrin and Rand? They all, the other one's the one who knows how to talk to women. And that's cute. I always liked that gag. But at the same time, there is, like you said, like a little bit of a schoolyard type of tone to these things versus, you know, like an Anne McCaffrey, like the Dragon Riders of Pern romances, they had some problems too, but like they were adults. They were very obviously adults in those books. I agree with what you're saying about the gender kind of dynamics in the Wheel of Time being one of its thornier issues. And sorry, Dan, that's probably not going to get better. That's bugging you now.
Oh yeah, I've accepted it. I know it's a part. I'm also weirded out that nobody seems to trust Moiraine. I don't get it. Like Nynaeve in her head is like, I don't want Moiraine anywhere near Rand. She's going to ruin him. And Rand's like, I'll never tell you what my plan is. And it's just, when has she not indicated she is very helpful and like good natured and wants to do the right thing? I do not get it. And I don't know if I'm just putting Rosamund Pike in there in my head and her like graceful, well-meaning demeanor and substituting that in, but it's, I don't know. I felt this way when I read the first book and like Moiraine is obviously the best character here. Why are all these idiots not trusting her? And that hasn't really gone away.
Yeah, I feel like maybe you've got some Rosamund Pike bias there. But so the main thing, that is another thing I did enjoy about this book, was the way that Rand and Moiraine's like dynamic evolves here, because I do think, you know, looking at them on the grander scale, right? So it's not just Rand and Moiraine, it's the Dragon Reborn and his main Aes Sedai advisor.
Yeah.
And the power dynamic kind of flips in this book, where previously
another
it was like
good development, by the way. Another movement forward.
Yes, yes. That's another thing I'm really kind of looking forward to this season, partially because Rosamund Pike and Yosha Stradowski, who play Moiraine and Rand, are both amazing. I can't wait to see the way they navigate that relationship flip, where now Rand is the one who has, I don't want to say more power, but Moiraine is trying to, she can't just tell him what to do anymore. So there's more of a almost like a manipulation back and forth between them, where he wants information from her. She doesn't really want to give him all the information he wants, maybe because she doesn't think it'd be best for him. She wants him to do stuff. He doesn't want to do what she wants him to do. So like, there's very much a push and pull. I think one thing that's important to remember when it comes to like, why don't these people just trust Moiraine more, is the probably centuries long bias of like cultural bias against Aes Sedai, as they will come and manipulate everything and they rule from the shadows basically, and you don't mess with them and they never tell you the truth, even though they literally cannot lie. So I think there's that element, which again, like, that's almost similar to the men are from Mars, women are from Venus thing, where it's like Robert Jordan playing on an idea of a thing, maybe to the extent where it feels almost unrealistic in the moment for characters. Like, no one trusts Aes Sedai, and it almost makes them, the characters seem like caricatures when, you know, Nynaeve is talking about how she will never, you know, won't let her sink her claws into Rand or whatever.
It's another one of those things where it's kind of not jiving with the way I have experienced the world, because, yeah, I get it. Aes Sedai are distrusted, but the way it usually works in the real world is a group is othered. But then when you actually get to know a member of the group, you kind of make a little exception for them in your head, where it's like, oh, yeah, they're the worst. Oh, them? Oh, yeah, he's great. I talk to him all the time. And it's like, they know Moiraine. Like, she's helped them for four books now. I kind of got it. I understood it more in the early going, but like now, like, now she's helped you so much. Like, she's a person you know. And Rand doesn't give, and I don't want to be true on this too much, but if she's like, Rand, can tell me what you're planning? He's like, don't worry about it. Like, he just gives her nothing.
Yeah. Well, I do think this is the book where, so Brandon Sanderson, who wrote the last three of this series, he said something that I really liked about The Shadow Rising and one of his podcasts in the recent past, where basically this is the book where Rand realizes no matter how powerful he gets, he can't fight the Dark One alone. He can't fight the Shadow alone, or even just with his friends. He needs an empire behind him. And this is the start of Rand deciding, I need to build an empire and get all the peoples of the world I can behind me for this fight. So I feel like, to some extent, Rand being like, I will not tell you things, Moiraine. There is some element of that that is Rand trying to step into his own as the Dragon Reborn, which we got a hint of in the previous book where he just like leaves all his friends. He's like,
yeah,
I need to go do what I need to do. It's probably dangerous for you to hang around me, and I know where I need to go, so I'm just going to go there. And that gets him in trouble, because obviously that's the flip side of this. Rand thinks he needs to do these things. Rand thinks he needs to push people away. He thinks he needs to not tell Moiraine things, even though what he actually needs is probably the opposite of all those things. Robert Jordan's really good at writing infuriating characters, I think, where sometimes they do things and you want to shake them and you're like, this is not what you need in your life. What are you doing? But like, that is part of what has made them resonate, you know, for so long with so many readers, I think, that these characters are unreliable to them and to themselves. Like, they self-sabotage. And I do think there's a smack of realism there, because, like, you know, lots of people have a streak of self-sabotage in their lives, you know?
Sure. I think it's a very nice way of framing it. And I'm not opposed to the angle. You could definitely argue that. I think you'd also probably argue, and I probably would, that there's depicting realistic streaks of self-sabotage, and there's making characters obstinate long past the point where it's believable. Like, I'm not saying necessarily happened here, but I think that's the side of that's the less flattering way of framing what's going on here.
Yeah, which is fair. And I, you know, there will be characters who have those obstinate streaks moving forward. I do think that some characters navigate that better than others throughout the books. Egwene is one who I really like, who I think has a pretty great story, where I was never like, man, Egwene, you're so rock-headed. Like, you know, she doesn't really have that. And part of that is because that's not the type of character she is. Like, whereas Nynaeve has always been one of my favorite characters in the Wheel of Time.
Me
because
too.
She is so obstinate, so frustrating, so irksome, but she has such a like heart of gold. She goes on a really big, like, character journey.
I mean, in the book, she's so obstinate and so pig-headed, it kind of comes around and it's funny again.
Yes,
but like,
totally.
It goes so far that I find it kind of endearing.
Absolutely.
It's more frustrating when someone like Rand does it. I mean, I still like when Nynaeve in her head is like, oh, Moiraine's the worst. It is obstinate and frustrating, but also there's a part of me, I don't know why I don't do it for other characters, but just like, oh, Nynaeve, you crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, she kind
but
of...
For Rand, I'm just like, I'm going to slap him and be like, Rand, wake up and smell the good advice.
Well, here's the... So I agree with that about Nynaeve. I think that's one of her charms, that she is so obstinate that it's endearing. Like,
it's painted 100%. As like... Oh, I think the difference is it's painted with Nynaeve as, if not a character flaw, then like a real character trait, like her anger. Whereas I feel like Rand is painted more as sort of like, I mean, he has a personality, but he doesn't have that trait. We're not like, we don't think of Rand as someone who's never trusts anybody or obstinate. So when he does it, it just like, what are you doing, bro?
Well, I think, and this is probably, I think the Dragon Reborn is really the start of this thread for Rand. Gets a little clearer here, and like from here on it's going to get clearer and clearer. Rand is not a solid light protagonist. Rand, there's always this note in the background, basically from here on, that Rand is struggling to not go mad. That he both literally and he's so scared of it that he pushes people away, doesn't trust people or himself. So I do think that's one thing. Like, you know, Matt is another one I think of similar to Nynaeve, like especially starting in like book three, where Matt is, his personality quirks are so pronounced that it ends up being endearing, even when he's being annoying. I'd you're like, that, oh, yeah. That Matt Coffin. But Rand, you know, his journey in the series, it gets really dark is all I'll say. Like, he has just as many moments where you're like, yeah, Rand's so heroic, as where you're like, oh shit, Rand, you need therapy or something. We get hints of that here, and that's only going to be more the case. So get used to not 100% rooting for Rand, even when you want to, I guess.
I'm looking forward to it. We haven't talked about the coup at the White Tower yet, which, by the way, I think they're also going to change, because isn't Min at the White Tower when it all goes down in the book, but she's in Tanchico in the images that we saw for the new season?
I believe that's correct. Yeah, Min is there and is a factor in, I don't remember the exact way that book four leaves off with the coup, right? Because it happens right at the end of the book.
I mean, it's definitely in the back part. I remember, I just read it more recently, Swan Sanche is freed, which, by the way, I mostly remember the aftermath of the coup, when they're kind of getting Swan Sanche out of prison and they're putting her in a horse. And there's like a nice description that she looks younger afterwards, which we can unpack. I've long wanted to have a think about, like, why are there so many all-female secret societies of sorceress shadow string pullers in these big epic fantasy series? The Aes Sedai, the Bene Gesserit, the Lodge of Sorceresses. It just kind of goes on and on. But that's enough for another day. Anyway, Swan Sanche gets out. And I liked kind of her transformation from, openly defiant to like quietly defiant to like briefly despairing to like, okay, let's get on with the job. Let's go. So I think I liked the aftermath of the coup. Was my favorite part of the coup, when it was like kind of recovering and picking up the pieces. And Min was there, by the way. So I'm not sure.
Yes.
She wasn't like a vital, I guess she was kind of like our person on the inside.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what they're going to like, who's going to be our new boots on the ground eyes on the coup in the show.
Well, we get a lot more time with Sawan out of the gate in the show than we have so far. With Sawan as basically the point of view, in a way we didn't get in the book until really this book is when Sawan starts to be a little more of a viewpoint. So I pulled up a summary of this. Shout out to Dragonmount, who has great summaries for the chapter by chapters.
Thank you.
So the reason you don't really remember the coup much is because the coup happens largely off page, off screen. Mm-hmm. So we see Sawan early in the book, and then we come back to her at the end, where you find out she was deposed and then put to the question and stilled. Then she looks younger. Like, that is a thorny, another one of these. I'm not sure what to make of this type things. I don't know how they'll do that in the show. Let me just say,
what they'll do is they'll just ignore it. Just probably. Like, this is weird, let's not go there.
They will probably just have her look normal and then start getting gray hairs and stuff, because she can actually age again.
Min
is the one who frees Sawan and Leanne, and then Gawain lets them out of the city. They take Loghain with them on the way out. I think we left on the note that Loghain was going to get sent to the White Tower in season two, after the whole Lanfear blows up Kyrian sequence. I'm pretty sure that was the note, was they were going to take him back to the White Tower. But yeah, it is a big question. If Min is in Tanchico, what is going to go down with Sawan? Presumably Gawain will still be involved somehow, because we know he was cast this season. The coup at the White Tower is one of those, again, one of those retrospect things. It's almost like Robert Jordan was writing a 14 book series, and it wasn't, a lot of these plot points weren't meant to really stand on their own until you saw a larger part of the picture, because we just find out the coup happened here, and it basically ends with Siwan and a few of her allies fleeing the tower while Elida takes control there. But a lot of the, I think the journey Siwan goes on from this point is really interesting. So it's another one of those, in retrospect, the coup is really cool and important.
I like it in this book. I just, I don't mind that it happened off screen. It doesn't, it's not a problem. Me neither. Page.
There's so much going on in this book. I didn't mind that at all. I was shocked that she was stilled, just because that has been very much put across as like the worst thing that can happen to an Aes Sedai. Either their warder dies or they get stilled. Those are like the two horrible things Aes Sedai can go through. And yeah, Siwan is stilled and deposed, and that it is interesting to see where she goes from here, because that is definitely a big dramatic shift. Once again, stuff is happening here. Different people are in control of the White Tower for the first time in the season. In the series.
I mean, yeah, you're talking as though all of this is set up for other stuff, and of course it is. It's going to be, but it didn't feel like set up when I'm reading it. It feels like forward momentum, which I think is what this book has going for it. I think if the show is smart, that's what they'll capitalize on.
Yeah,
and I'm looking forward to both the next book and the third season of the TV show.
Yeah, I right there with you. I can't wait for season 3, premieres on March 13th. And I'm really excited for you to read The Fires of Heaven too. That is one of the more like divisive books in the fan base, where some people really don't like it, some people do. I always really liked it, largely because of the end. I think the Fires of Heaven has a really cool ending. But yeah, that one too, it's almost like a unit with The Shadow Rising, which I won't talk about too much for spoilers, but like, you know, talking about how some of these, like, they don't feel like setup to you, they just feel like cool plot developments. And some of, probably part of the reason, at least I'm thinking of it that way, is because these two books really feel like they are, I don't want to say like a duology, but like they're continuing a lot of the same plot lines before we move into new territory. So like, we will see more of the Aiel and Rand navigating their cultural stuff in the fifth book, and Siwan navigating her situation and all of that kind of stuff. So yeah, these two really do feel like a pair in a way that not every book in the series feels like it has a clear pairing like this. So yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait for you to read the next one and to do this all over again. Yeah,
exactly. Maybe we'll do a video on that too. And when we do, we'll post it here on the Winners Coming YouTube page. And if you like, we also do live shows every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Central Standard Time on the Winners Coming YouTube page, Facebook page. Give us a like, give us a subscribe, leave a comment so it gets into the algorithm, other people find it and hear our very important opinions. Daniel, I'm kind of wrapping up here, but do you have anything you want to say about The Shadow Rising or life in general before we sign off?
Shadow Rising or the life in general. I don't think so. I'm just, you know, I'm really excited for the third season of the television show. I know that it's had to change a lot of things from the books, but somehow it still feels like the most faithful adaptation, even though it's wildly different out of a lot of these big recent fantasy show adaptations.
I agree with you.
It feels more like they're changing things because they just don't have a choice. And sometimes that isn't clear right away why that is the case. I can mention this here. We talked about this in, I think, our last podcast. I hated that they changed Moiraine losing her powers in the second season. I really hated that. Realized late in the season they did it so they could teach viewers about the whole like tying off weaves of the One Power to capture a person, basically. And once they did that reveal, I was like, okay, I can see why you did this now. That's a lot better. I know why we needed this. The reason we needed that last season is so that when Rand and Lanfear do it to Asmodee in this season, we'll know what's happening. So yeah, The show has my faith. I'm excited to see what they do with this book. Good material. Cannot wait.
I know that some Wheel of Time fans do not like the show that's changed so much. When I watch the show, it does feel like there is a hand with a plan over it in a way that I don't always feel when watching some of these other big genre dramas. And that is comforting. So I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to talking about it with you. Looking forward to bringing more content to all you fine people. So thanks for watching. Check back here as often as you possibly can. Share us far and wide. And have a pleasant afternoon, morning, or evening, depending on when you watch this. Goodbye.
Take care, all.
This podcast is brought to you by FanSided. Join our community of over 300 sites from sports to pop culture and everything in between.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.